The Disney-esque tone of the museum reflects, among other things, many of the similarities between the McDonald's Corporation and the Walt Disney Company. It also reflects the similar paths of the two men who founded these corporate giants. Ray Kroc and Walt Disney were both from Illinois. They were born a year apart, Disney in 1901, Kroc in 1902. They knew each other as young men, serving together in the same World War I ambulance corps. And they both fled the Midwest and settled in Southern California, where they played central roles in the creation of new American industries. The film critic Richard Schickel has described Disney's powerful inner need to order, control, and keep clean any environment he inhabited. The same could easily be said about Ray Kroc, whose obsession with cleanliness and control became one of the hallmarks of his restaurant chain. Kroc cleaned the holes in his mop wringer with a toothbrush. Kroc and Disney both dropped out of high school and later added the trappings of formal education to their companies. The training school for Disney's theme park employees was named Disneyland University. More importantly, the two men shared the same vision of America, the same optimistic faith in technology, the same conservative political views. They were charismatic figures who provided an overall corporate vision and grasped the public mood, relying on others to handle the creative and financial details. Walt Disney neither wrote nor drew the animated classics that bore his name. Ray Kroc's attempts to add new dishes to McDonald's menu, such as Kolaki, a bohemian pastry, and the Hula Burger, a sandwich featuring grilled pineapple and cheese, were unsuccessful. Both men, however, knew how to find and motivate the right talent. While Disney was much more famous and achieved success sooner, Kroc may have been more influential. His company inspired more imitators, wielded more power over the American economy, and spawned a mascot even more famous than Mickey Mouse. Despite all their success as businessmen and entrepreneurs, as cultural figures and advocates for a particular brand of Americanism, perhaps the most significant achievement of these two men lay elsewhere. Walt Disney and Ray Kroc were masterful salesmen. They perfected the art of selling things to children. And their success led many others to aim marketing efforts at kids, turning America's youngest consumers into a demographic group that is now avidly studied, analyzed, and targeted by the world's largest corporations. Ray Kroc took the McDonald Brothers' speedy service system and spread it nationwide, creating a fast food empire. Although he founded a company that came to symbolize corporate America, Kroc was never a buttoned-down corporate type. He was a former jazz musician who'd played at speakeasies and at a bordello on at least one occasion during Prohibition. He was a charming, funny, and indefatigable traveling salesman who endured many years of disappointment. Of Willie Loman, who finally managed to hit it big in his early 60s. Over the years, Kroc sold coffee beans, sheet music, paper cups, Florida real estate, powdered instant beverages called Malt-a-Plenty and Shake-a-Plenty, a gadget that could dispense whipping cream or shaving lather, and square ice cream scoops. He was selling milkshake mixers in 1954 when he visited the new McDonald's self-service restaurant in San Bernardino. The McDonald brothers were two of his best customers. The multi-mixer unit that Kroc sold could make 5 milkshakes at once. He wondered why the McDonald brothers needed 8 of the machines. Kroc had visited a lot of restaurant kitchens out on the road, demonstrating the multi-mixer, and had never seen anything like the McDonald's speedy service system. When I saw it, he later wrote, I felt like some latter-day Newton who just had an Idaho potato caromed off his skull. He looked at the restaurant through the eyes of a salesman and envisioned putting a McDonald's at busy intersections all across the land. Richard and Mac McDonald were less ambitious. They were clearing $100,000 a year in profits from the restaurant, a huge sum in those days. They already owned a big house and 3 Cadillacs. They didn't like to travel. They'd recently refused an offer from the Carnation Milk Company, which thought that opening more McDonald's would increase the sales of milkshakes. Nevertheless, Kruk convinced the brothers to sell him the right to franchise McDonald's nationwide. The two could stay at home while Kruk traveled the country, making them even richer. A deal was signed. After finalizing the agreement with the McDonald brothers, Kruk sent a letter to Walt Disney. In 1917, the two men had both lied about their ages to join the Red Cross and see battle in Europe. A long time had clearly passed since their last conversation. "Dear Walt," the letter said, "I feel somewhat presumptuous addressing you in this way, yet I feel sure you would not want me to address you any other way. My name is Ray A. Kruk. I look over the Company A picture we had taken at Sound Beach, Connecticut many times, and recall a lot of pleasant memories. After the warm-up came the pitch. I have very recently taken over the national franchise of the McDonald's system. I would like to inquire if there may be an opportunity for a McDonald's in your Disneyland development." Walt Disney sent Kruk a cordial reply and forwarded his proposal to an executive in charge of the theme park's concessions. Disneyland was still under construction. Its opening was eagerly awaited by millions of American children, and Kruk may have had high hopes. According to one account, Disney's company asked Kruk to raise the price of McDonald's French fries from 10 cents to 15 cents. Disney would keep the extra nickel as payment for granting the concession. And the story ends with Ray Kruk refusing to gouge his loyal customers. The account seems highly unlikely, a belated effort by someone at McDonald's to put the best spin on a sales pitch that went nowhere. When Disneyland opened in July of 1955, an event that Ronald Reagan co-hosted for ABC, it had food stands run by Welch's, Stouffer's, and Aunt Jemima's, but no McDonald's. Kruk was not yet in their league. His recollection of Walt Disney as a young man, briefly mentioned in his book Riding It Out, is not entirely flattering. "He was regarded as a strange duck," Kruk wrote of Disney, "because whenever we had time off and went out on the town to chase girls, he stayed in camp, drawing pictures." Whatever feelings existed between the two men, Walt Disney proved in many respects to be a role model for Ray Kruk. Disney's success had come much more quickly. At the age of 21, he'd left the Midwest and opened his own movie studio in Los Angeles. He was famous before turning 30. In The Magic Kingdom, 1997, Stephen Watts describes Walt Disney's efforts to apply the techniques of mass production to Hollywood movie making. He greatly admired Henry Ford and introduced an assembly line and a rigorous division of labor at the Disney studio, which was soon depicted as a fun factory. The working conditions at Disney's factory, however, were not always fun. In 1941, hundreds of Disney animators went on strike, expressing support for the Screen Cartoonists Guild. The other major cartoon studios in Hollywood had already signed agreements with the union. Disney's father was an ardent socialist, and Disney's films had long expressed a populist celebration of the common man. But Walt's response to the strike betrayed a different political sensibility. He fired employees who were sympathetic to the union, allowed private guards to rough up workers on the picket line, tried to impose a phony company union, brought in an organized crime figure from Chicago to rig a settlement, and placed a full-page ad in Variety that accused leaders of the Screen Cartoonists Guild of being communists. The strike finally ended when Disney acceded to the union's demands. The experience left him feeling embittered. Convinced that communist agents had been responsible for his troubles, Disney subsequently appeared as a friendly witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee, served as a secret informer for the FBI, and strongly supported the Hollywood blacklist. During the height of labor tension at his studio, Disney had made a speech to a group of employees arguing that the solution to their problems rested not with a labor union, but with a good day's work. "Don't forget this," Disney told them. "It's the law of the universe that the strong shall survive and the weak must fall by the way. And I don't give a damn what idealistic plan is cooked up. Nothing can change that." Decades later, Ray Kruk used similar language to outline his own political philosophy. Kruk's years on the road as a traveling salesman, carrying his own order forms and sample books, knocking on doors, facing each new customer alone, and having countless doors slammed in his face, no doubt influenced his view of humanity. "Look, it is ridiculous to call this an industry," Kroc told a reporter in 1972, dismissing any high-minded analysis of the fast food business. This is rat eat rat, dog eat dog. I'll kill them, and I'm going to kill them before they kill me. You're talking about the American way of survival of the fittest. While Disney-backed right-wing groups and produced campaign ads for the Republican Party, Kroc remained aloof from electoral politics, with one notable exception. In 1972, Kroc gave $250,000 to President Nixon's re-election campaign, breaking the gift into smaller donations, funneling the money through various state and local Republican committees. Nixon had every reason to like McDonald's, long before tasting one of its hamburgers. Kroc had never met the president. The gift did not stem from any personal friendship or fondness. That year, the fast food industry was lobbying Congress and the White House to pass new legislation, known as the McDonald's Bill, that would allow employers to pay 16- and 17-year-old kids' wages 20% lower than the minimum wage. Around the time of Kroc's $250,000 donation, McDonald's crew members earned about $1.60 an hour. The sub-minimum wage proposal would reduce some wages to $1.28 an hour. The Nixon administration supported the McDonald's bill and permitted McDonald's to raise the price of its quarter pounders despite the mandatory wage and price controls restricting other fast food chains. The size and the timing of Kroc's political contribution sparked Democratic accusations of influence peddling. Outraged by the charges, Kroc later called his critics sons of bitches. The uproar left him wary of backing political candidates. Nevertheless, Kroc retained a soft spot for Calvin Coolidge, whose thoughts on hard work and self-reliance were prominently displayed at McDonald's corporate headquarters. Despite a passionate opposition to socialism and to any government meddling with free enterprise, Walt Disney relied on federal funds in the 1940s to keep his business afloat. The animators' strike had left the Disney studio in a precarious financial condition. Disney began to seek government contracts, and those contracts were soon responsible for 90% of his studio's output. During World War II, Walt Disney produced scores of military training and propaganda films, including Food Will Win the War and A Few Quick Facts About Venereal Disease. After the war, Disney continued to work closely with top military officials and military contractors, becoming America's most popular exponent of Cold War science. For audiences living in fear of nuclear annihilation, Walt Disney became a source of reassurance, making the latest technical advances seem marvelous and exciting. His faith in the goodness of American technology was succinctly expressed by the title of a film that the Disney studio produced for Westinghouse Electric, The Dawn of Better Living. Disney's passion for science found expression in Tomorrowland, the name given to a section of his theme park and to segments of his weekly television show. Tomorrowland encompassed everything from space travel to the household appliances of the future, depicting progress as a relentless march toward greater convenience for consumers. And yet, from the very beginning, there was a dark side to this Tomorrowland. It celebrated technology without moral qualms. The future heralded at Disneyland was one in which every aspect of American life had a corporate sponsor. Walt Disney was the most beloved children's entertainer in the country. He had unrivaled access to impressionable young minds, and other corporations with other agendas to sell were eager to come along for the ride. Monsanto built Disneyland's House of the Future, which was made of plastic. General Electric backed the Carousel of Progress, which featured an audio-animatronic housewife standing in her futuristic kitchen singing about a great big beautiful tomorrow. "Here you leave today," said the plaque at the entrance to Disneyland, and enter the world of yesterday, tomorrow, and fantasy. At first, Disneyland offered visitors an extraordinary feeling of escape. People had never seen anything like it. The great irony, of course, is that Disney's suburban corporate world of tomorrow would soon become the Anaheim of today. Within a decade of its opening, Disneyland was no longer set amid a rural idyll of orange groves. It was stuck in the middle of cheap motels, traffic jams on the Santa Ana Freeway, fast food joints, and industrial parks. Walt Disney frequently slept at his small apartment above the firehouse in Disneyland's Main Street, USA. By the early 1960s, the hard realities of today were more and more difficult to ignore, and Disney began dreaming of bigger things, of Disney World, a place even farther removed from the forces he'd helped to unleash, a fantasy that could be even more thoroughly controlled. Among other cultural innovations, Walt Disney pioneered the marketing strategy, now known as Synergy. During the 1930s, he signed licensing agreements with dozens of firms, granting them the right to use Mickey Mouse on their products and in their ads. In 1938, Snow White proved a turning point in film marketing. Disney had signed 70 licensing deals prior to the film's release. Snow White toys, books, clothes, snacks, and records were all ready for sale when the film opened. Disney later used television to achieve a degree of synergy beyond anything that anyone had previously dared. His first television broadcast, One Hour in Wonderland, 1950, culminated in a promotion for the upcoming Disney film, Alice in Wonderland. His first television series, Disneyland, 1954, provided weekly updates on the construction work at his theme park. Ray Kroc could only dream, during McDonald's tough early years, of having such marketing tools at his disposal. He was forced to rely instead on his wits, his charisma, and his instinct for promotion. Kroc believed completely in whatever he sold and pitched McDonald's franchises with an almost religious fervor. He also knew a few things about publicity, having auditioned talent for a Chicago radio station in the 1920s and performed in nightclubs for years. Kroc hired a publicity firm led by a gag writer and a former MGM road manager to get McDonald's into the news. Children would be the new restaurant chain's target customers. The McDonald brothers had aimed for a family crowd, and now Kroc improved and refined their marketing strategy. He'd picked the right moment. America was in the middle of a baby boom. The number of children had soared in the decade after World War II. Kroc wanted to create a safe, clean, all-American place for kids. He knew that how he sold food was just as important as how the food tasted. The McDonald's Corporation's first mascot was Speedy, a winking little chef with a hamburger for a head. The character was later renamed Archie McDonald. Speedy was the name of Alka-Seltzer's mascot, and it seemed unwise to imply any connection between the two brands. In 1960, Oscar Goldstein, a McDonald's franchisee in Washington, D.C., decided to sponsor Bozo's Circus, a local children's television show. Bozo's appearance at a McDonald's restaurant drew large crowds. When a local NBC station canceled Bozo's Circus in 1963, Goldstein hired its star, Willard Scott, later the weatherman on NBC's Today Show, to invent a new clown who could make restaurant appearances. An ad agency designed the outfit, Scott came up with the name Ronald McDonald, and a star was born. 2 years later, the McDonald's Corporation introduced Ronald McDonald to the rest of the United States through a major ad campaign. But Willard Scott no longer played the part. He was deemed too overweight. McDonald's wanted someone thinner to sell its burgers, shakes, and fries. The late 1960s expansion of the McDonald's restaurant chain coincided with declining fortunes at the Walt Disney Company. Disney was no longer alive, and his vision of America embodied just about everything that kids of the 60s were rebelling against. Although McDonald's was hardly a promoter of whole foods and psychedelia, it had the great advantage of seeming new, and there was something trippy about Ronald McDonald, his clothes, and his friends. As McDonald's mascot began to rival Mickey Mouse in name recognition, Kroc made plans to create his own Disneyland. He was a highly competitive man who liked, whenever possible, to settle the score. He planned to buy 1,500 acres of land northeast of Los Angeles and build a new amusement park there. The park, tentatively called Western World, would have a cowboy theme. Other McDonald's executives opposed the idea, worried that Western World would divert funds from the restaurant business and lose millions. Kroc offered to option the land with his own money, but finally listened to his close advisors and scrapped the plan. The McDonald's Corporation later considered buying Astro World in Houston. Instead of investing in a large theme park, the company pursued a more decentralized approach. It built small playlands and McDonald lands all over the United States. The fantasy world of McDonald Land borrowed a good deal from Walt Disney's Magic Kingdom. Don Ament, who gave McDonald Land its distinctive look, was a former Disney set designer. Richard and Robert Sherman, who had written and composed, among other things, all the songs in Disney's Mary Poppins, Disney's It's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, and It's a Small World After All, were enlisted for the first McDonaldland commercials. Ronald McDonald, Mayor McCheese, and the other characters in the ads made McDonald's seem like more than just another place to eat. McDonaldland, with its hamburger patch, apple pie trees, and Filet-O-Fish fountain, had one crucial thing in common with Disneyland. Almost everything in it was for sale. McDonald's soon loomed large in the imagination of toddlers, the intended audience for the ads. The restaurant chain evoked a series of pleasing images in a youngster's mind. Bright colors, a playground, a toy, a clown, a drink with a straw, little pieces of food wrapped up like a present. Kroc had succeeded, like his old Red Cross comrade, at selling something intangible to children, along with their fries. 25 years ago, only a handful of American companies directed their marketing at children. Disney, McDonald's, candy makers, toy makers, manufacturers of breakfast cereal. Today, children are being targeted by phone companies, oil companies, and automobile companies, as well as clothing stores and restaurant chains. The explosion in children's advertising occurred during the 1980s. Many working parents, feeling guilty about spending less time with their kids, started spending more money on them. One marketing expert has called the 1980s the decade of the child consumer. After largely ignoring children for years, Madison Avenue began to scrutinize and pursue them. Major ad agencies now have children's divisions, and a variety of marketing firms focus solely on kids. These groups tend to have sweet-sounding names: Small Talk, Kid Connection, Kid to Kid, the Geppetto Group, Just Kids, Inc., at least three industry publications, Youth Market Alert, Selling to Kids, and Marketing to Kids Report, cover the latest ad campaigns and market research. The growth in children's advertising has been driven by efforts to increase not just current, but also future consumption. Hoping that nostalgic childhood memories of a brand will lead to a lifetime of purchases, companies now plan cradle-to-grave advertising strategies. They have come to believe what Ray Kroc and Walt Disney realized long ago: a person's brand loyalty may begin as early as the age of 2. Indeed, market research has found that children often recognize a brand logo before they can recognize their own name. The bulk of the advertising directed at children today has an immediate goal. It's not just getting kids to whine, one marketer explained in Selling to Kids. It's giving them a specific reason to ask for the product. Years ago, sociologist Vance Packard described children as surrogate salesmen who had to persuade other people, usually their parents, to buy what they wanted. Marketers now use different terms to explain the intended response to their ads. such as leverage, the nudge factor, pester power. The aim of most children's advertising is straightforward: get kids to nag their parents and nag them well. Children's clubs have for years been considered an effective means of targeting ads and collecting demographic information. The clubs appeal to a child's fundamental need for status and belonging. Disney's Mickey Mouse Club, formed in 1930, was one of the trailblazers. During the 1980s and 1990s, children's clubs proliferated as corporations used them to solicit the names, addresses, zip codes, and personal comments of young customers. A well-designed and well-run children's club can be extremely good for business. According to one Burger King executive, the creation of a Burger King Kids Club in 1991 increased the sales of children's meals as much as 300%. The Internet has become another powerful tool for assembling data about children. In 1998, a federal investigation of websites aimed at children found that 89% requested personal information from kids. Only 1% required that children obtain parental approval before supplying the information. A character on the McDonald's website told children that Ronald McDonald was the ultimate authority in everything. The site encouraged kids to send Ronald an email revealing their favorite menu item at McDonald's, their favorite book, their favorite sports team, and their name. Fast food websites no longer ask children to provide personal information without first gaining parental approval. To do so is now a violation of federal law, thanks to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which took effect in April of 2000. Despite the growing importance of the Internet, television remains the primary medium for children's advertising. The effects of these TV ads have long been a subject of controversy. In 1978, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, tried to ban all television ads directed at children 7 years or younger. Many studies had found that young children often could not tell the difference between television programming and television advertising. They also could not comprehend the real purpose of commercials and trusted that advertising claims were true. The FTC's proposed ban was supported by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the National Congress of Parents and Teachers, among others. But it was attacked by the National Association of Broadcasters, the Toy Manufacturers of America, and the Association of National Advertisers. The industry groups lobbied Congress to prevent any restrictions on children's ads and sued in federal court to block Michael Perchuk, head of the FTC, from participating in future FTC meetings on the subject. In April of 1981, 3 months after the inauguration of President Ronald Reagan, an FTC staff report argued that a ban on ads aimed at children would be impractical, effectively killing the proposal. The Saturday morning children's ads that caused angry debates 20 years ago now seem almost quaint. Far from being banned, TV advertising aimed at kids is now broadcast 24 hours a day, closed captioned, and in stereo. Nickelodeon, the Disney Channel, the Cartoon Network, and the other children's cable networks are now responsible for about 80% of all television viewing by kids. None of these networks existed before 1979. The typical American child now spends about 21 hours a week watching television, roughly 1.5 months of TV every year. That does not include the time children spend in front of a screen watching videos, playing video games, or using the computer. Outside of school, the typical American child spends more time watching television than doing any other activity except sleeping. During the course of a year, he or she watches more than 30,000 TV commercials. Even the nation's youngest children are watching a great deal of television. About one quarter of American children between the ages of 2 and 5 have a TV in their room. Although the fast food chains annually spend about $3 billion on television advertising, their marketing efforts directed at children extend far beyond such conventional ads. The McDonald's Corporation now operates more than 8,000 playgrounds at its restaurants in the United States. Burger King has more than 2,000. A manufacturer of Playlands explains why fast food operators build these largely plastic structures. Playlands bring in children who bring in parents who bring in money. As American cities and towns spend less money on children's recreation, fast food restaurants have become gathering spaces for families with young children. Every month, about 90% of American children between the ages of 3 and 9 visit a McDonald's. The seesaws, slides, and pits full of plastic balls have proven to be an effective lure. But when it gets down to brass tacks, a Brand Week article on fast food notes, the key to attracting kids is toys, toys, toys. The fast food industry has forged promotional links with the nation's leading toy manufacturers, giving away simple toys with children's meals and selling more elaborate ones at a discount. The major toy crazes of recent years, including Pokemon cards, Cabbage Patch Kids, and Tamagotchis, have been abetted by fast food promotions. A successful promotion easily doubles or triples the weekly sales volume of children's meals. The chains often distribute numerous versions of a toy, encouraging repeat visits by small children and adult collectors who hope to obtain complete sets. In 1999, McDonald's distributed 80 different types of Furby. According to a publication called Tomart's Price Guide to McDonald's Happy Meal Collectibles, some fast food giveaways are now worth hundreds of dollars. Rod Taylor, a Brand Week columnist, called McDonald's 1997 Teeny Beanie Baby giveaway one of the most successful promotions in the history of American advertising. At the time, McDonald's sold about 10 million Happy Meals in a typical week. Over the course of 10 days in April of 1997, by including a Teeny Beanie Baby with each purchase, McDonald's sold about 100 million Happy Meals. The competition for young customers has led the fast food chains to form marketing alliances not just with toy companies, but with sports leagues and Hollywood studios. McDonald's has staged promotions with the National Basketball Association and the Olympics. Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, and KFC signed a 3-year deal with the NCAA. Wendy's has linked with the National Hockey League. Burger King and Nickelodeon, Denny's and Major League Baseball, McDonald's and the Fox Kids Network have all formed partnerships that mix advertisements for fast food with children's entertainment. Burger King has sold chicken nuggets shaped like Teletubbies. In May of 1996, the Walt Disney Company signed a 10-year global marketing agreement with the McDonald's Corporation. By linking with a fast food company, a Hollywood studio typically gains anywhere from $25 million to $45 million in additional advertising for a film, often doubling its ad budget. These licensing deals are usually negotiated on a per-film basis. The 1996 agreement with Disney gave McDonald's exclusive rights to that studio's output of films and videos. The life's work of Walt Disney and Ray Kroc had come full circle, uniting in perfect synergy. McDonald's began to sell its hamburgers and French fries at Disney's theme parks. The ethos of McDonaldland and of Disneyland, never far apart, have finally become one. Now you can buy a Happy Meal at the happiest place on earth. Not satisfied with marketing to children through playgrounds, toys, cartoons, movies, videos, charities, and amusement parks, through contests, sweepstakes, games, and clubs, via television, radio, magazines, and the internet, fast food chains are now gaining access to the last advertising-free outposts of American life. In 1993, District 11 in Colorado Springs started a nationwide trend, becoming the first public school district in the United States to place ads for Burger King in its hallways and on the sides of its school buses. Like other school systems in Colorado, District 11 faced revenue shortfalls thanks to growing enrollments and voter hostility to tax increases for education. The initial Burger King and King Super ad contracts were a disappointment for the district, gaining it just $37,500 a year, little more than $1 per student. In 1996, school administrators decided to seek negotiating help from a professional, hiring Dan DeRose, president of DD Marketing Incorporated of Pueblo, Colorado. DeRose assembled special advertising packages for corporate sponsors. For $12,000, a company got 5 school bus ads, hallway ads in all 52 of the district schools, ads in their school newspapers, a stadium banner, ads over the stadium's public address system during games, and free tickets to high school sporting events. Within a year, DeRose had nearly tripled District 11's ad revenues, but his greatest success was still to come. In August of 1997, DeRose brokered a 10-year deal that made Coca-Cola the district's exclusive beverage supplier, bringing the schools up to $11 million during the life of the contract, minus DD Marketing's fee. The deal also provided free use of a 1998 Chevy Cavalier to a District 11 high school senior, chosen by lottery, who had good grades and a perfect attendance record. District 11's marketing efforts were soon imitated by other school districts in Colorado, by districts in Pueblo, Fort Collins, Denver, and Cherry Creek. Administrators in Colorado Springs did not come up with the idea of using corporate sponsorship to cover shortfalls in a school district's budget, but they took it to a whole new level, packaging it, systematizing it, leading the way. Hundreds of public school districts across the United States are now adopting or considering similar arrangements. Children spend about 7 hours a day, 150 days a year, in school. Those hours have, in the past, been largely free of advertising, promotion, and market research, a source of frustration to many companies. Today, the nation's fast food chains are marketing their products in public schools through conventional ad campaigns, classroom teaching materials, and lunchroom franchises, as well as a number of unorthodox means. The proponents of advertising in the schools argue that it's necessary to prevent further cutbacks. Opponents contend that school children are becoming a captive audience for marketers, compelled by law to attend school and then forced to look at ads as a means of paying for their own education. America's schools now loom as a potential goldmine for companies in search of young customers. Discover your own river of revenue at the schoolhouse gates, urged a brochure at the 1997 Kids Power Marketing Conference. Whether it's first graders learning to read or teenagers shopping for their first car, we can guarantee an introduction of your product and your company to these students in the traditional setting of the classroom. The nation's 3 major beverage manufacturers are now spending large sums to increase the amount of soda that American children consume. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Cadbury Schweppes, the maker of Dr. Pepper, control 90.3% of the U.S. market, but have been hurt by declining sales in Asia. Americans already drink soda at an annual rate of about 56 gallons per person. That's nearly 600 12-ounce cans of soda per person. Coca-Cola has set itself the goal of raising consumption of its products in the United States by at least 25% a year. The adult market is stagnant. Selling more soda to kids has become one of the easiest ways to meet sales projections. Influencing elementary school students is very important to soft drink marketers, an article in the January 1999 issue of Beverage Industry explained, because children are still establishing their tastes and habits. 8-year-olds are considered ideal customers. They have about 65 years of purchasing in front of them. Entering the schools makes perfect sense, the trade journal concluded. The fast food chains also benefit enormously when children drink more soda. The chicken nuggets, hamburgers, and other main courses sold at fast food restaurants usually have the lowest profit margins. Soda has by far the highest. We at McDonald's are thankful, a top executive once told the New York Times, that people like drinks with their sandwiches. Today, McDonald's sells more Coca-Cola than anyone else in the world. The fast food chains purchase Coca-Cola syrup for about $4.25 a gallon. A medium Coke that sells for $1.29 contains roughly 9 cents worth of syrup. Buying a large Coke for $1.49 instead, as the cute girl behind the counter always suggests, will add another 3 cents worth of syrup and another 17 cents in pure profit for McDonald's. Liquid candy, a 1999 study by the Center for Science and the Public Interest, describes who is not benefiting from the beverage industry's latest marketing efforts: the nation's children. In 1978, the typical teenage boy in the United States drank about 7 ounces of soda every day. Today, he drinks nearly 3 times that amount, deriving 9% of his daily caloric intake from soft drinks. Soda consumption among teenaged girls has doubled within the same period, reaching an average of 12 ounces a day. A significant number of teenage boys are now drinking 5 or more cans of soda every day. Each can contains the equivalent of about 10 teaspoons of sugar. Coke, Pepsi, Mountain Dew, and Dr. Pepper also contain caffeine. These sodas provide empty calories and have replaced far more nutritious beverages in the American diet. Excessive soda consumption in childhood can lead to calcium deficiencies and a greater likelihood of bone fractures. 20 years ago, teenage boys in the United States drank twice as much milk as soda. Now they drink twice as much soda as milk. Soft drink consumption has also become commonplace among American toddlers. About 1/5 of the nation's 1- and 2-year-olds now drink soda. In one of the most despicable marketing gambits, Michael Jacobson, the author of Liquid Candy, reports, Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, and 7-Up encourage feeding soft drinks to babies by licensing their logos to a major maker of baby bottles, Munchkin Bottling Incorporated. A 1997 study published in the Journal of Dentistry for Children found that many infants were indeed being fed soda in those bottles. The school marketing efforts of the large soda companies have not gone entirely unopposed. Administrators in San Francisco and Seattle have refused to allow any advertising in their schools. It's our responsibility to make it clear that schools are here to serve children, not commercial interests, declared a member of the San Francisco Board of Education. Individual protests have occurred as well. In March of 1998, 1,200 students at Greenbrier High School in Evans, Georgia, assembled in the school parking lot, many of them wearing red and white clothing, to spell out the word Coke. It was Coke and Education Day at the school, and a dozen Coca-Cola executives had come for the occasion. Greenbrier High was hoping for a $500 prize, which had been offered to the local high school that came up with the best marketing plan for Coca-Cola discount cards. As part of the festivities, Coke executives had lectured the students on economics and helped them bake a Coca-Cola cake. A photographer was hoisted above the parking lot by a crane, ready to record the human C-O-K-E for posterity. When the photographer started to take pictures, Mike Cameron, a Greenbrier senior, standing amid the letters C, suddenly revealed a T-shirt that said, Pepsi. His act of defiance soon received nationwide publicity, as did the fact that he was immediately suspended from school. The principal said Cameron could have been suspended for a week for the prank, but removed him from classes for just a day. I don't consider this a prank, Mike Cameron told the Washington Post. I like to be an individual. That's the way I am. The fast food chains run ads on Channel 1, the commercial television network, whose programming is now shown in classrooms almost every school day to 8 million of the nation's middle, junior, and high school students, a teen audience 50 times larger than that of MTV. The fast food chains place ads with Star Broadcasting, a Minnesota company that pipes top 40 radio into school hallways, lounges, and cafeterias. And the chains now promote their food by selling school lunches, accepting a lower profit margin in order to create brand loyalty. At least 20 school districts in the United States have their own Subway franchises, an additional 1,500 districts have Subway delivery contracts, and 9 operate Subway sandwich carts. Taco Bell products are sold in about 4,500 school cafeterias. Pizza Hut, Domino's, and McDonald's are now selling food in the nation's schools. The American Food Service Association estimates that about 30% of the public high schools in the United States offer branded fast food. Elementary schools in Fort Collins, Colorado, now serve food from Pizza Hut, McDonald's, and Subway on special lunch days. "We try to be more like the fast food places where these kids are hanging out," a Colorado school administrator told the Denver Post. "We want kids to think school lunch is a cool thing, the cafeteria is a cool place, that we're with it, that we're not institutional." The new corporate partnerships often put school officials in an awkward position. The Coca-Cola deal that DDD Marketing negotiated for Colorado Springs School District 11 was not as lucrative as it first seemed. The contract specified annual sales quotas. School District 11 was obligated to sell at least 70,000 cases of Coca-Cola products a year within the first 3 years of the contract, or it would face reduced payments by Coke. During the 1997-98 school year, the district's elementary, middle, and high schools sold only 21,000 cases of Coca-Cola products. Kara DeGette, the features editor of the Colorado Springs Independent, a weekly newspaper, obtained a memorandum sent to school principals by John Bushy, a District 11 administrator. On September 28, 1998, at the start of the new school year, Bushy warned the principals that beverage sales were falling short of projections and that as a result, school revenues might be affected. "Allow students to bring Coke products into the classrooms," he suggested. "Move Coke machines to places where they would be more accessible to students all day." "Research shows that vendor purchases are closely linked to availability," Bushy wrote. "Location, location, location is the key." If the principals felt uncomfortable allowing kids to drink Coca-Cola during class, he recommended letting them drink the fruit juices, teas, and bottled waters also sold in the Coke machines. At the end of the memo, John Bushy signed his name and then identified himself as the Coke dude. Behind the counter. The view of Colorado Springs from Gold Camp Road is spectacular. The old road takes you from the city limits to Cripple Creek, once a gold mining town with real outlaws, now an outpost of casino gambling full of one-armed bandits and day trippers from Aurora. The tourist buses drive to Cripple Creek on Highway 67, which is paved. Gold Camp Road is a dirt road through the foothills of Pikes Peak, a former wagon trail that has narrow hairpin turns, no guardrails, and plenty of sheer drops. For years, kids from Cheyenne Mountain High School have come up here on weekend nights, parked at spots with good aerial views, and partied. On a clear night, the stars in the sky and the lights of the city seem linked, as though one were reflecting the other. The cars and trucks on Interstate 25, heading north to Denver and south toward Pueblo, are tiny, slow-moving specks of white. The lights dwindle as the city gives way to the plains. At the horizon, the land looks darker than the sky. The great beauty of this scene is diminished when the sun rises, and you can clearly see what's happening down below. Driving through the neighborhoods of Colorado Springs often seems like passing through layers of sedimentary rock, each one providing a snapshot of a different historical era. Downtown Colorado Springs still has an old-fashioned, independent spirit. Aside from a Kinko's, a Brugger's Bagel Bakery, a Subway, and a couple of Starbucks, there are no chain stores, not a single Gap in sight. An eclectic mixture of locally owned businesses line Tejon Street, the main drag. The Chinook Bookshop, toward the north end, is as fiercely independent as they come, the sort of literate and civilized bookstore going out of business nationwide. Further down Tejon, there's an ice cream parlor named Michelle's that has been in business for almost 50 years. And around the corner, there's a Western wear shop called Lorig's that's outfitted local ranchers since 1932. An old movie palace, nicknamed The Peak and renovated with lots of neon, has a funky charm that could never be mass-produced. But when you leave downtown and drive northeast, you head toward a whole new world. The north end of the city near Colorado College is full of old Victorian houses and mission-style bungalows from the early part of this century. Then come Spanish-style and adobe houses that were popular between the World Wars. Then come split-level colonials and ranch-style houses from the Leave It to Beaver era. Small, modest, cheery homes. Once you hit Academy Boulevard, you're surrounded by the hard, tangible evidence of what has happened in Colorado during the last 20 years. Immense subdivisions with names like Sagewood, Summerfield, and Fairfax Ridge blanket the land. Thousands upon thousands of nearly identical houses, the architectural equivalent of fast food, covering the prairie without the slightest respect for its natural forms, built on hilltops and ridgetops, just begging for a lightning strike, ringed by gates and brick walls and puny, newly planted trees that bend in the wind. The houses seem not to have been constructed by hand, but manufactured by some gigantic machine, cast in the same mold and somehow dropped here fully made. You can easily get lost in these new subdivisions, lost for hours passing from Norwood to Briar Gate to Stetson Hills, from Antelope Meadows to Chapel Ridge, without ever finding anything of significance to differentiate one block from another, except their numbers. Roads end without warning, and sidewalks run straight into the prairie, blocked by tall wild grasses that have not yet been turned into lawns. Academy Boulevard lies at the heart of the new sprawl, serving as its main north-south artery. Every few miles, clusters of fast food joints seem to repeat themselves. Burger Kings, Wendy's, and McDonald's, Subways, Pizza Huts, and Taco Bells. They keep appearing along the road, the same buildings and signage replaying like a tape loop. You can drive for 20 minutes, pass another fast food cluster, and feel like you've gotten nowhere. In the bumper-to-bumper traffic of the evening rush hour, when the cars and the pavement and the strip malls are bathed in twilight, when the mountains in the distance are momentarily obscured, Academy Boulevard looks just like Harbor Boulevard in Anaheim, except newer. It looks like countless other retail strips in Orange County, and the resemblance is hardly coincidental. The new housing developments in Colorado Springs not only resemble those of Southern California, they are inhabited by thousands of people who've recently left California. An entire way of life, along with its economic underpinnings, has been transposed from the West Coast to the Rockies. Since the early 1990s, Colorado Springs has been one of the fastest-growing cities in the nation. The mountains, clear air, wide-open spaces, and unusually mild climate have drawn people tired of the traffic, crime, and pollution elsewhere. About a third of the city's inhabitants have lived there less than 5 years. In many ways, Colorado Springs today is what Los Angeles was 50 years ago, a mecca for the disenchanted middle class, a harbinger of cultural trends, a glimpse of the future. Since 1970, the population of the Colorado Springs metropolitan area has more than doubled, reaching about 500,000. The city is now an exemplar of low-density sprawl. Denver's population is about 4 times larger, and yet Colorado Springs covers more land. Much like Los Angeles, Colorado Springs was a sleepy tourist town in the early part of the 20th century, an enclave of wealthy invalids and retirees surrounded by ranchland. Nicknamed Little London, the city was a playground for the offspring of eastern financiers, penniless aristocrats, and miners who'd struck it rich in Cripple Creek. The town's leading attractions were the Broadmoor Hotel and the Garden of the Gods, an assortment of large rock formations. During the Great Depression, tourism plummeted, people moved away, and about one-fifth of the city's housing sat vacant. The outbreak of World War II provided a great economic opportunity. like Los Angeles, Colorado Springs soon became dependent on military spending. The opening of Camp Carson and Peterson Army Air Base brought thousands of troops to the area, along with a direct capital investment of $30 million and an annual payroll of twice that amount. After the war, Colorado Springs gained a series of new military bases, thanks to its strategic location, mid-continent beyond the range of Soviet bombers, its fine weather, and the friendships formed between local businessmen and Air Force officers at the Broadmoor. In 1951, the Air Defense Command moved to the city, eventually becoming the North American Aerospace Command, with its outpost deep within Cheyenne Mountain. The number of Army and Air Force personnel stationed in Colorado Springs subsequently grew to be larger than the city's entire population before World War II. Although the local economy is far more diversified today, nearly half the jobs in Colorado Springs still depend upon military spending. Much of the Star Wars anti-missile defense system is being designed and tested at Schriever Air Force Base, a dozen miles east of the city. And Peterson Air Force Base now houses one of America's newest and most high-tech units, the U.S. Space Command. The presence of these high-tech military installations attracted defense contractors to Colorado Springs, mainly from California. Colorado Springs now views itself as a place on the cutting edge, the high-tech capital of the Rockies. The new businesses and residents from Southern California brought a new set of attitudes. In 1946, R.C. Hoyles, the owner of the Orange County Register and later the founder of the Freedom newspaper chain, purchased the largest daily newspaper in Colorado Springs, the Gazette Telegraph. Hoyles was politically conservative, a champion of competition and free enterprise. His editorials had attacked Herbert Hoover for being too left-wing. In the 1980s, the Freedom newspaper chain purchased the Gazette's only rival in town, the Colorado Springs Sun, a struggling paper with a more liberal outlook. After buying the Sun, Freedom Newspapers fired all its employees and shut it down. In 1990, James Dobson decided to move Focus on the Family, a religious organization, from the Los Angeles suburb of Pomona to Colorado Springs. Dobson is a child psychologist and radio personality, as well as the author of a best-selling guide for parents, Dare to Discipline, 1970. The arrival of Focus on the Family helped turn Colorado Springs into a magnet for evangelical Christian groups. The city had always been more conservative than Denver, but that conservatism was usually expressed in the sort of live-and-let-live attitude common in the American West. During the early 1990s, religious groups in Colorado Springs became outspoken opponents of feminism, homosexuality, and Darwin's theory of evolution. Today, there is not a single elected official in Colorado Springs or in El Paso County, the surrounding jurisdiction, who's a registered Democrat. Indeed, the Democratic Party did not even run a candidate for Congress there in 2000. The political changes that have lately swept through the city have also taken place in a less extreme form throughout the Rocky Mountain West. A generation ago, the region was one of the most liberal in the country. In 1972, all of the governors in the eight mountain states, Arizona, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico, Wyoming, even Idaho and Utah, were Democrats. By 1998, all of the governors in these states were Republicans, as were three-quarters of the U.S. senators. The region is now more staunchly Republican than the American South. Colorado Springs now has the feel of a city whose identity is not yet fixed. Many longtime residents strongly oppose the extremism of the newcomers, sporting bumper stickers that say, "Don't Californicate Colorado." The city is now torn between opposing visions of what America should be. Colorado Springs has 28 charismatic Christian churches and almost twice as many pawnbrokers, a Lord's Vineyard bookstore, and a First Amendment adult bookstore, a Christian Medical and Dental Society, and a Holy Rollers tattoo parlor. It has a Christian summer camp whose founder, David Noble, outlined the dangers of rock and roll in his pamphlet, Communism, Hypnotism, and the Beatles. It has a gay entertainment complex called the Hide and Seek, where the Gay Rodeo Association meets. It has a public school principal who recently disciplined a group of sixth grade girls for reading a book on witchcraft and allegedly casting spells. The loopiness, once associated with Los Angeles, has come full-blown to Colorado Springs. The strange, creative energy that crops up where the future's consciously being made, where people walk the fine line separating a visionary from a total nutcase. At the start of a new century, all sorts of things seem possible there. The cultural and the physical landscapes of Colorado Springs are up for grabs.